Hey, folks, I know there are lots of business owners who listen to this show. Maybe some of you never planned on running a business, but now here you are. One thing you've always got to keep in mind is how much you're spending on your operating costs. That's one of the first things we had to keep in mind with WTF. And with things costing more today than they did when we started, you want to keep your expenses down. To reduce costs and headaches, be smart and use NetSuite by Oracle, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform and one source of truth. Reduce IT costs, cut the costs of maintaining multiple systems, improve efficiency by bringing all your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. By popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/WTF for more. That's NetSuite, NetSuite.com/WTF.
Lock the gates!
All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers? What the fuck buddies? What the fuck sticks? What the fuck stirs? What's happening? Everything all right? Are you okay? Did you get vaxxed? Are you half vaxxed? Are you fully vaxxed? Are you not vaxxed? Are you not vaxxing? Silly boys, silly girls, silly theys. Get the vax. Let's push it back. What's the problem? You got vaccines when you were a kid. Stop being weird. Get the vax. Let's stop this shit already. Today on the show, I talked to Katie Segal. You know her from Married with Children and Sons of Anarchy. She has a new show on ABC called Rebel. She also grew up in show business. Yes, her family's a show business family. She's an accomplished singer. And I would like you to know that this show is a lot of recovery talk. It's like recovery week here. But that's okay. It's good. We get into some of the food issue stuff, some of the codependent, dirty co stuff. Are you a dirty co? Get into some of the drinky, druggy stuff. Because I don't care what anybody says or how anybody reacted around, Hunter. But the truth is, addicts and alcoholics are stigmatized. Anybody who needs help and is openly asking for help is stigmatized in this country. I mean, it's sort of like, you know, it's along the same arc as anti-vaxxers. It's like you should be able to fight it. You should be able to pull yourself up by your bootstraps. You should be able to not need help. That's, you know, you're not really sick. Your body's fine. It's your brain, but it's just not true. But societally, that is still the deal. And that's one of the reasons that Anonymous is anonymous. You know, I choose to be public about my sobriety because I think it helps other people. But a lot of people can't because they'll be judged. Goes on your record. That's one of the reasons it's anonymous. You know what I mean? You got to keep it to yourself unless you want to be public about it to help other people. That's my belief. But out there in the world, no matter how much of it is out there, no matter how many people know people who have drug problems, there's still some part of it that, you know, people look at them as weak or as a problem or as potentially a trouble. Some of that may be true. But either way, it should be recognized as something that people need help with and accepted as a sickness. Anyway, all that being said, Katie Segal is here and we did talk about it a bit. Did you guys watch that documentary on HBO Max or HBO or whatever the fuck it is? What is it, Q Into the Storm? What a great documentary. It really was well done. This guy invested, what's this guy's name? Cullen Hoback. He went in there, man. He was there at the beginning of Q and at the beginning of the problem, and he put 3 years into this. Figured out the through line, figured out the players, figured out the effect it had on people, and really kind of made a kind of well-rounded, well-researched, and true doc. Did not infuse himself too much into it, like so many documentarians do. They become part of it. Their ego you know, needs the attention and that it becomes half about them. He didn't do that. He was there. His presence was felt. And he didn't really cross the line except for once. And it was for good reason and really added to the drama of the thing. But you do kind of get to the end of the line of this thing and realize that the entire Q phenomenon was spearheaded by, you know, most likely, seemingly, this father and son team of nihilistic nerds who kind of broke the brains of millions of people and broke the world. The fact that a couple of malcontents with malintentions could start this up online and break the fucking world and sort of send thousands, hundreds of thousands of people's brains spinning away from them into a direction they, to the point where they might not get their brains back, is sort of daunting and terrifying that it was that easy. Granted, look, man, I'm not saying they're all powerful. People really want to believe things. They really want stories that have closure. They want things to be explained. They want their anger to be honored. They want to feel part of something bigger than themselves. And if you get them angry enough and frothed up enough, they'll kill people to realize it. But it does get to the bottom of it. It makes me think about, how do these people that got played by this bullshit feel? I mean, I know most of them are too proud to admit they got played and probably will just, you know, kind of live off the fumes of the thing and try to pull out what they think is true and real that has some substantiation. But how does it feel to be that fucking played? Obviously, look, man, we're all marks. We've all been played by one thing or another. And that's sort of one of the hinges of conspiratorial thinking. It's like, what are you a mark for? How do you know what you know is real? You know, what do you base your perception on? What do you think your identity is hanging on? What are the facts? Who are you really? What is true really? You know, I mean, that's the game, right? We're all kind of marks, but to see where this went, just for the sort of power tripping goof of a couple of fucking people who figured it out online, and then it got glommed onto by thousands and thousands of lost, angry people, but also it got taken advantage of by people who were hip to the power of it. Then they hip the pathological, lying pig president, and he glommed onto it and used it. It was kind of fascinating. The whole thing is fascinating. That a couple of people, expats, father and son team, maybe could break the fucking world, break the brains, disassociate hundreds of thousands of people, and start a viral series of ideas that eat away at the truth like acid. So Katie Segal and I think that there's a moment here, and you'll hear it during our conversation, where there's this kind of aha, we are alike moment. And it's around food issues. You know, I guess people who know me and know this show know that I'm kind of fucked up like that. But I will tell you this, as a man, as a he, his, you can call me they if you want. But, you know, I am a dude with massive food issues, massive body dysmorphia, hyper aware, like to the point where, like, if I feel uncomfortable in my body because of what I perceive as being heavy or weight or fat or whatever I perceive, that feeling is so paralyzing that I almost can't breathe. I can't be touched. I don't want to be seen. There have been times where I don't want to live, you know, despite all of my other, what some people would say, neuroses, which they are not. I mean, but aside from my, you know, drug addiction in the past, my addictive personality, or whatever shortcomings I may have, however I may be fucked up, whatever I may think of myself, these food issues, these eating issues are the deepest ones, and they're completely fucking paralyzing and terrible. you know, to be so aware all the time of what you eat, why you eat it, and then the cycles of self-hatred, the cycles of body hatred, the cycles of, you know, compulsive weighing. And then if you do get into a role where you start losing weight, that thrill of being sort of exhausted and loopy from being anorexic in your intent to maintain a certain weight or keep getting lower. If you look at the third season of Glow, I'm surprised that nobody thought I had cancer as that character, because I started to lose a little weight just so I could eat on set and not feel bad about it. But then it got away from me and I just kept losing and losing and I looked terrible. But it's very hard for me to balance that shit. So much of my sense of self is wrapped up in how I feel about my weight. I can't even explain it. How fucking deep that issue is, and how it makes you want to die inside. And oddly, you know, I probably don't get the help or work a program around it that I should, because it really is my deepest issue. But it was just to say that you're not alone out there, fellas, who pinch themselves when they feel fat or have a series of poking gestures around their stomach to check the density of what they perceive as their weight. Maybe that's uniquely me. I don't know. But I do know that me and Katie bonded around that. We bonded around juice stuff. We bonded around booze and drugs and recovery. And it was a great talk. It was great to see her. I felt like we'd known each other for centuries. Her new show, Rebel, airs Thursdays on ABC. It premieres tonight at 10 p.m. Eastern. And this is me talking to a Katie Segal.
I'm really happy to be here, by the way.
Nice to see you.
I'm a big fan.
Are you?
Uh-huh.
That's very nice, he is.
So true.
I watched the pilot of the new thing.
What'd you think?
Of Rebel. It's exciting. You know, it's you're out there kicking ass with like nine kids, all different races and genders.
Yes, many different husbands. Yes,
I think it's interesting that how some shows seek to accommodate the diversity. How are you going to do it?
Yes. Well, even though this is a fictitious approach.
Right.
Right.
But like it's I've never seen it done like this where it's like that's your kid too.
Yeah. And then all different races.
But you can carry it.
It happens.
The character, it does. But the character seems like somebody who could do that.
Absolutely. Well, she's got three different husbands.
And, yeah.
You know, one's adopted, one kid's adopted.
Oh, okay.
So,
right.
You know, they're all just different races.
And one's a doctor from a cop.
One's a doctor from a cop.
One's a lawyer from a lawyer.
After being a juvenile delinquent. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. No, I'm not a lawyer. Oh, no,
no
her
no.
dad's a lawyer.
Right.
Yeah, so you know more.
Right.
I haven't seen...
It's not important. You know, you just walk in.
We're mid. You know, we're midway. I mean, I actually did see the pilot, but it was, you know, I don't know about you, but watching myself is not always my favorite thing to do.
I can't. It's hard.
Yeah. And I zipped out. I was sort of like, oh, I think this is, you know, I just kind of, it was out of body experience.
What do you experience when you do it? Like when you watch yourself, what is the feeling?
First, I'm hypercritical.
Right.
You know, way too hypercritical and really self-obsessed.
Yeah.
Like all I can see is me.
Right. Oh, well, yeah. It's, yeah.
And then I have to watch. If I watch it again
yeah.
a couple times, then I can see the whole project.
Uh-huh.
But
right.
at first, I'm just like all about me.
Yeah. I think I'm pretty much all about me on every viewing. And then occasionally... And then occasionally I'm like, I'm working with somebody. They're doing a good job. Thank God they're doing such a good job. But I've gotten less critical of myself as time goes on.
Oh.
But it's hard when you watch yourself on television because it if you're hypercritical of it, it's all stilted. It's just the nature of the medium, right? Because they're not, you know, you're pulling off a trick in acting like you're really talking to somebody in a way. You know what I mean? Like,
yes.
Like in the sense that like a lot of dialogue that happens in those compressed stories, it's sort of unnatural.
Yes.
So
well, yes.
In general, right? So for me, like I always feel that weird air in between lines if I'm watching myself, like because it's not, you're acting. So it's not quite natural. And I'm like, oh, why can't I, if we looked more relaxed or why didn't I make it seem more natural or, you know?
Yeah. Or why couldn't they have shot this when it was off camera? It was so much better.
Yeah, we were so loose.
So loose and so much better. Didn't give a shit. Just threw it away.
Yeah. So this is based on Erin Brockovich, kind of?
Yes, it's inspired by Erin Brockovich.
And she's involved?
She's an executive producer, yes.
I think she's a fan of mine.
Oh.
I think.
I'm sure she is.
Well, I mean, we've tweeted at each other.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know how, you know.
She's very cool.
Yeah?
I think she would. Yeah, you should have her on your show. She's awesome.
I think it'll happen.
Yeah.
Yeah.
She's really great and fighting the good fight. So, yeah, it's loosely based. Well, yeah, it's inspired by her, but we don't have her life rights, so it's not her life. It's just...
She wouldn't give them, or they're already owned, or
they're
spoken for?
I don't know what the deal was. I don't know.
She's an executive producer, but she can't give you the life rights because she's promised that.
She might have given them to somebody else.
She's going
to do something awesome. That's why she gave them to them. I don't know.
I don't know. But she is involved, and it is sort of inspired by her, and you're sort of like what would you call this character? Sort
she's
of
a consumer advocate. A voice for the little guy.
Yeah.
That's what she is.
What network is it on?
It's on ABC.
Andy Garcia? Yes. Haven't seen him in a while.
So awesome.
Is it fun to work with him?
Oh, my God. Well, he's such a movie star. So he's got all these, like, killer movie star stories. Which
does he? And he sits around and tells them?
Yeah, in the most endearing, fabulous way. Like, he'll just throw out the names of these famous directors. And this one did this and this one did that. And, you know, I'm just like, I'm enthralled.
Yeah.
I love the way he tells stories.
He's intense, it seems.
He's intense? Well, he's Cuban.
Yeah.
And so he has this passionate Cuban way. And he's very, you know, he's proud of being Cuban. He loves that he's playing a Cuban character.
Right, yeah, sure.
You know, and he'll tell the director, that's not how the Cuban would do it. And so, you know... It's a different rhythm, but he does. He's a very passionate, super funny dude.
Yeah.
I mean, people don't think would be funny. He's funny.
I think he's funny. I've seen him kind of play that dry funny in the Ocean's movies.
Yeah,
sometimes
he's funny.
He's sort of the straight guy. He's kind of the steaming funny guy.
Yeah.
The guy who's like always getting fucked.
Yeah. And in this project, he kind of just, you know, I just order him around.
Yeah.
And he, you know, he loves
to do that
me,
with
but
everybody.
He takes it. I guess so.
You like it?
Ordering people around.
Yeah.
I actually don't in my real life, but it's super fun to play.
Yeah, I bet.
Because they listen.
It kind of gets a little off your chest.
It does. Absolutely, it does.
Yeah.
It's very liberating.
And then there's that other guy from Northern Exposure who I feel like I haven't seen in forever.
John Corbett. Yeah.
It's so interesting to check in with people as they get older. Like, oh, look, you're doing all right.
Yeah, he's doing fine.
Yeah.
He's like in all these... He's in that, what's that Netflix, All the Boys I Loved Before or All the Things.
Oh, right. Yeah, he's in that.
He's in that.
Yeah.
And, you know, he's Mr. Dreamy guy.
Is he a nice guy?
He's a super nice guy.
Really?
Yeah, I'm not going to say anything bad about anybody I'm working with right now.
No, I don't
So far, everybody's
I don't
good.
Know why I asked you that. I mean, what are you going to say?
What am I going to say?
He's a fucking asshole. Don't say anything to anybody. But,
No, he's cool.
Yeah.
Everybody's pretty cool so far. Everybody's grateful to have a job after everything that we've just all been through.
Were you shooting it with protocols?
We are now.
You are now? Oh, right.
We were
right.
about to shoot the pilot just when all this went down. And
so
everything shut down.
So how much have you shot?
We are on episode 6.
Oh, so you guys are going up and you're going to be in it while they're airing.
Yeah. And we just have a 10-episode order. So
that doesn't usually happen. Usually they're all in the can, aren't they? Or am I making that up?
No,
they are. Usually.
They are. And there's a whole, you know, there's that ridiculous pilot process, which we got to skip. They just picked us up straight to series.
Oh, as opposed to
shooting a pilot and waiting around and then hearing if you do
right.
so.
So you seem like you've never really stopped working.
Well, no, I mean, yes, I have stopped working. I mean, I have 3 children, so I've stopped, you know, stopped
to
and
have
started.
Them and to be
yeah,
with
to,
them
to have them and be with them and
try to make them turn out okay.
Yeah, and they're so far so good. So
how old?
I have 26, 25, and 14. I have
14.
A teenager at home. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, I'm an old mom. I had a kid with Kurt, who's my 3rd husband. I mean, it's kind of, you know, a little bit like the part
Sons
I'm playing.
Of Anarchy guy?
Sons of Anarchy guy, yep.
He created that show?
He created it.
And you fell in love on the set of the biker show?
No. We met in a 12-step program. And
I'm familiar with those.
Yeah. I'm long time in that. So
all of them or just one? 2?
Oh, I've been to all. There's probably a few more in my future. I, too, am quite obsessive. So, we met in a 12-step room, and he was working on The Shield. He worked on that show.
With Chiklis.
And I was, you know, getting out of the marriage number two. And I don't know if I had a gig then. Oh, I think I was on Eight Simple Rules, which is a show I did with John Ritter. And then, you know, he wrote the motorcycle show with me in mind after we were married. So
really?
Yeah, it was nice. Actually, she was written to be a smaller character. And then the network was like, nah, let's bump her up.
That's nice. So he's got the swaggering, you know, chickless and then the swaggering you.
Yeah, which was so great in my career because I had been so known for comedy that it had been very difficult for people to realize that I'm actually not funny and I'm much more serious than that, which is totally the truth. And so he wrote me this great dramatic role.
Yeah.
And it was really, it opened finally.
A life changer?
Kind of, yeah, work-wise.
But you grew up in show business, which always, like, and I read that, so, and it fascinates me when people grow up in this business. Yeah. Because it seems like, I mean, you were here when it was, you know, glamorous and exciting and
my life,
great.
Not glamorous. It was my father. This is the part everybody doesn't know.
What?
You know, it's hardworking. My dad was an episodic television director, basically.
Yeah.
You know, he did Man from U.N.C.L.E.
Oh,
he did
wow.
Dr. Kildare. Old stuff. And, you know, worked his butt off. I mean,
he never did films?
He did. He did The Omega Man.
Oh,
did you ever
hear
The Omega Man?
With Charlton Heston?
Yeah. That was his movie. And I think ultimately he would have liked to have done more films, but he had a family with five kids. And
five kids?
Yeah.
There are five of you?
Yeah. Five of us.
Same mom?
Same mom.
Where did he come from?
My dad was from Russia, came here when he was seven with his Yiddish mother who never ever spoke English.
What part of Russia?
They were from what is now, I'm not going to be able to pronounce the name right.
Is it Belarus? Ukraine?
No, Ukraine.
They're
from Ukraine.
Yeah, that's where I my family's from,
yeah.
Part of it.
So his side,
yeah.
His side is that. The other side is apparently I'm an Amish person from the other side.
What are you talking about?
I did that show. You know that show, Who Do You Think You Are?
Oh,
the
yeah.
Lisa
I did
Kudrow
another one.
Show?
Yeah.
Oh, you did The Roots?
Yeah.
Oh, you know what? I think I saw your Roots.
Yeah.
I love that show.
Yeah, it was all Jew. It was a Jew Roots.
It was
me and Terry Gross and Jeff Goldblum.
Oh, it was fantastic. I saw that episode.
Yeah.
I loved it.
Yeah.
No, and I thought for sure when they, you know, they put you on that show, they don't tell you what they're going to do.
Sure.
Right? So I thought for sure they're taking me to Russia because that's the most interesting part of my life.
Yeah.
Turns out my mother was Amish royalty, like a way back. So they're taking me to Pennsylvania. I'm meeting all these
And you thought she
relatives.
Was Jewish?
No, no. I knew my mother was not Jewish. I knew she was a white person from like, you know.
Pennsylvania?
Somewhere.
Yeah.
She was like a big mix of stuff. But yeah, so I'm Amish and Russian.
So they took you to Amish land?
They did. And they took me generations back. I met all these cousins named Hofstedler. I mean, it was really wild.
That seems so like incongruous to who you are and who you're. Did that affect your sense of identity?
Well, I do. No, I was going to make a joke, but no, I'm not going to say that. No, not really. I've always felt more sort of a Russian Jewish. My father was a very big personality. And so, you know, I've always felt stronger on that side of my family.
Was your mom in show business?
My mother was. My mother started as a singer when she was 11. She was called the Singing Sweetheart of Cherokee County and had her own radio show.
Really? Where was this?
In Gaffney, South Carolina.
So she was on like the old-timey radio show?
Yeah, like 15 minutes a day.
It's probably sponsored by a flower, or a sausage or something?
Something. I tried to track it down. I could never find it.
Oh, nothing, huh?
But then she went on to be a writer. She worked for, here's a long story. She worked for Norman Lear. Norman Lear.
I interviewed him.
Ah,
he's 100
best.
Now. Well, how old is he?
He's so 97.
It's crazy.
He's my godfather.
Really?
He introduced my parents, my mother and my father.
What was he doing then? Like writing for Danny Thomas or something?
Yiddish theater.
Yiddish theater in New York or here? Here?
Out here.
No kidding. So it was before television.
No, television was happening because my mother was the script supervisor on the Martin and Lewis show.
Okay,
Martin
the variety show.
Yeah.
Right.
My parents have been dead a long time, so it's kind of like lore.
Yeah.
But anyway, so my mother was working for Norman. Norman knew my dad through directing in the Yiddish theater and hooked him up.
Your dad directed in Yiddish theater,
too? Yes, my dad.
So everybody spoke Yiddish?
Everybody, Yiddish.
Did you?
No. No.
My grandparents used to when they didn't want me to understand what they were talking about.
Right. My grandmother always did. She never learned English.
Really?
No. She never spoke English.
And you guys grew up in like Hollywood?
I was born in Hollywood. And then I grew up all around, you know, my dad was like a journeyman, you know, he did what we did, like circus people.
Yeah.
So, you know, we grew up, I just moved around a lot as the family grew.
In this area?
Yeah, we ended up on the west side.
Yeah.
Because things were well, things were good.
Right.
Yeah, but I just
And they stayed married? Your parents?
Well, my mother died when she was 47. She was young.
Oh my God, from what?
She had heart disease.
It's terrible.
Yeah, and she had some other stuff. And so my mom died when I was 19, 20. Mm. Oh. And then my dad remarried. And my dad remarried. Do you know who Gower and March Champion are?
I know. I wish I did.
They were like the Fred and Ginger of Broadway.
Oh, okay. Okay.
So, anyway, March Champion was big. So he married March Champion.
The dancer.
She was, yes, the dancer.
Okay.
She was my stepmother until, you know, my father died. Then it gets all sad. It gets a little bit sad.
Well, let's do it at the beginning here.
The sad part?
Sure.
Okay. Yeah. All in my 20s was a little bit funky. Lots of loss. Lots of sad.
He died. How'd he die?
He was killed on a set. My dad was directing a movie called World War III, and he was doing second unit, and he was up on a mountain with a helicopter, and he got disoriented, couldn't get a shot, walked the wrong direction into the helicopter.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. So that was like horrific.
And you're in your 20s.
And in my 20s.
And you got, where are you in the sibling
lineup? I'm number one. I'm the first.
So you're the oldest.
I'm the oldest.
So you got all these younger siblings, and now both parents are gone.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'd like to say that I kind of stepped in, but I didn't. I just checked out. I just got further and further into a dark hole.
Well, what were you doing at that time? When did you start, like, manifesting your talents?
Well, you know, I worked as a musician. I never wanted to be an actor.
Right. But like when you were a kid with all this show business around, were you doing stuff? Were you singing and dancing? Were you?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I was in bands. I was like, mom taught me to play the guitar.
What,
when
like
I was
in the late
10.
60s kind of deal?
Yeah. No. My mom taught me to play the guitar mid 60s.
Yeah.
Like I was 10, 11.
Yeah.
And I could always sing. I was a singer. And I had this kind of, you know, I had an ability. I was good. And
right.
So from a young age, I was in bands.
Rock bands?
Rock bands with
Great.
The older boys.
Yeah.
It was fun.
Anybody like, did anyone go on to do big things in your rock bands?
Not from high school, but later on I met a lot of, yeah.
Well, then you were like, I think in the rock business, weren't you?
Well, I
basically,
yeah, pretty much. I mean, I was, you know, kind of a struggling. I mean, I made records, and I was a struggling background singer, and I was like a demo singer. You know, they'd put you in the studio.
So, how does this work? So, okay, so Norman Lear is your godfather. So you spend time on sets, I imagine, as a kid.
Yeah, if I wanted friends in elementary school, yeah. I'd bring them to the set.
Wrong. Okay.
Because they didn't like me otherwise.
And
so,
you never got worked into a show
yet? I did. My father, when I was 16, decided, my dad always thought I should be an actor.
Right.
Which is one reason I never wanted to be an actor, because he wanted me to be one.
Uh-huh.
That's another story. But he wanted
Why were you
me,
pushing back on the old man?
Just pushing back.
Yeah.
Just because that's my nature.
Yeah. Was he like what kind of Jew was he? Was he like a stocky kind of loud Jew?
Loud.
Cigars involved?
Cigars.
Okay.
Ascots on the set. If you go to any set, every set I've worked on, people knew my dad.
Really?
And they loved him. They loved him. And I would look at
what
them
was
and
his
like,
name?
Boris. Mm. Boris Segal.
Mm-hmm.
Loved him. And then I would, you know, because he was different when he came home. He was tired and loud. And I remember thinking.
Is loud a nice word for angry?
Kind of, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, big. Big.
Not
yeah.
boozy, though?
You know, boozy in that. No, not alcoholic like me.
Right.
But boozy in that, like, martini way, like,
okay.
every day at whatever.
Sure.
You know, when you come home in a little Milltown. Do you remember Milltown?
The liquor?
No, that's a pill.
Oh,
that's
it's
like
a pill?
It's like
a pre-Valium?
Pre-Valium,
yeah.
Yeah.
So
there was that. And, Yeah, so he was that guy. And so I didn't, whatever he said, you know, he said left and I said right. That was that kind
just
of relationship.
Just to define yourself.
Pretty much. Mm. And
so did he work you in somewhere?
He did. He wanted me to have a union card. So he wanted me to have health insurance. Yeah. So when I was 16, he wrote me into, he got me a job on this TV movie that he did with Dean Stockwell.
Oh, Dean Stockwell, yeah. Sure, yeah.
And so I had a part on that. And then he also directed me in a Columbo. I was in high school, because you had to have two jobs to get a union card, right?
To be Taft Hartley.
Right,
in.
Exactly. Yeah. So he got me a union card, which to this day, I'm just so, you know, because it's hard to get in the union. When
is it?
Oh, my gosh. I have two. My older kids are both actors.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a big hurdle. They're in the union now.
Why? Because there's less union shoots or like,
no,
don't you have to sort of get Taft Hartley after two jobs anyways? You're only allowed to have two jobs before.
Yeah. But you can't get a job. It's kind of that catch 22.
Oh, right.
Like,
I get you.
You have to
be in
the union.
Someone has to give it to you.
Exactly.
You got it right.
Yeah. You have to know somebody.
Right. I got mine from my friend Steve Brill put me in The Mighty Ducks 2.
Oh.
I was cut out, but I got my card. I don't
Who
remember.
Who cares? It's good to get your card.
So you did Columbo. Do you like that? Must have been exciting, though, right? Did you Peter Falk? No, nothing.
I did a movie years later with Peter Falk. Right,
you did?
At the end of his life, yes.
Oh.
And that, that was pretty great. I don't really remember him when he was Columbo. I remember Jeff Goldblum was on the episode that I did.
A young Jeff
Goldblum? I totally remember him.
Well,
yeah.
He's so quirky and weird.
He was so quirky and weird, and he gave me a ride home, and I was sort of thinking like, wow, is he hitting on me? I don't know what he's
was
doing.
Was he?
He might have been. I don't know. I haven't talked to him. You know, I haven't talked to him since, so, but I think he's quite the man about town.
He'd love to hear it. He'd be like, ooh. Of course I remember.
Maybe he was. Yeah, but then... you know, then I love to play music. That's what I love to do. I still do.
But like, I'm trying to picture this. I always am fascinated with this time in Hollywood where you were like in your 20s in the 70s, which is like, that was the decade where it was just like a party in the streets, right? It was insanity everywhere. Just drugs, music.
Yep.
People, you know, where, like, it was like post-hippie insanity.
Well, it was kind of, so 1975, I'm 20 years old. So it was that period all the way through mid 80s that it was really, you know.
It took a big shift too. The hair got bad.
The shoulder pads got big.
Yeah, like the mid 70s. Like, so when you were in high school or 18 or 17, that was when it was cool. Then it's when we probably had the best pants.
Yeah. And then it got, I was sort of like in between. I was like, you know. Pre, like, go to San Francisco and protest the war. 69, I was 13.
Right.
You know,
so, yeah, you missed it.
Must have been much better to be 16. And I wasn't.
Right. But you got the 70s, though. So you got the music and the cars and everything.
Yeah.
And you start singing in a band in high school.
Start singing in a band in high school.
And then when do you start to go professional? How does that happen?
I went to CalArts out of high school.
Out in Valencia or wherever it is? Where is it?
It's in Valencia. And my dad.
So many
said,
people went there. Don Cheadle, Alison Brie.
I was in a class with Paul Rubens.
Yeah.
David Hasselhoff.
Wow. That's a big.
Yeah, it was wild. My dad said to me, I said, well, I want to go to that school because I didn't have any grades in high school. I was completely like, you know, I couldn't get into a regular.
What happened? Were you using then?
Oh, yeah. I was. And I was also just not going to school.
What was your thing?
I was smoking a lot of weed. I was drinking Red Mountain wine.
Red Mountain,
and
is that
I
like
took
Boone's
a lot
Farm
of speed.
Or yeah?
Yeah.
Like Black Beauties, White Cross?
Black Beauties, White Cross, yeah. Yeah, all that.
Wow.
The fun stuff, you know.
Benzies.
Second all,
that's the other way.
Yeah. My mom had a lot of second all in the house.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That's lucky.
Yeah. Well, that was that generation, too. I mean, it was like... they
right,
just,
second all, Valium,
up,
Librium.
Down. Yeah, all that.
And the diet pills.
Oh, that's exactly what started. That's how it started.
What, the diet pills?
I was a fat kid, apparently. Even though I looked at myself, I just thought I'd looked, you know, curvy.
But I was a fat kid. No, I was told I was a fat kid.
You were a fat kid?
I was. My mother made me believe that.
Do you still think you're a fat kid?
Yeah, I'm obese right now.
100%. I hear you. Oh, man. Do you have to do that thing where you just can't look in the mirror sometimes?
Yeah.
Body dysmorphia, it's called.
I have body dysmorphia. It's my deepest issue.
Oh, my God. We are so alike. I just saw a billboard of myself, a fucking billboard of myself in, you know, this rebel show that I'm in.
Yeah.
I call this girl that I sponsor, and she says, take a picture. I take the picture. I said, oh, I look fat.
I can't.
And she's like, she said, you are insane. I said, look, I know. I know I'm nuts, but that's what I see.
I'm so fucking nuts. I can't shake it.
It's a tough one to shake.
Because my mother's anorexic. So, like, I grew up with this. My mother recently, or as many times in my life, has said, I don't think I could love you if you were fat. But it turns out that was not even true. She said to me, like, a few Thanksgivings ago, just casually, she said, you know, Mark, when you were a baby, I don't think I knew how to love you. I'm like, I guess we've solved it.
Or you should have said, I knew that. I kind of pieced that together.
I just, the weird sort of glib honesty was kind of mind blowing. But the point about the weight is she has maintained a weight of like 116 pounds for decades.
Wow.
And that's her whole life.
Yeah. She's obsessed. So she passed that on to you.
Totally.
Yeah.
And it's the worst.
It is the worst.
I weighed myself this morning and I was like, wow. I had a body dysmorphia morning because like last night I was like, I'm fucked. And I exercise constantly.
And you look great, by the way.
Thank you. And I got on the scale this morning. I'm like, wow, I was wrong. This is an okay day.
You have to put away the scale. This is so funny. We're having this conversation. My husband and I are both this way. We're all.
Did you make him that way, though?
Oh, no, no, no. He came to me that way.
Because you can make people this way that you're with.
My children.
Oh, yeah. Like, I noticed that about relationships I've had, and I noticed it about my father, because it's contagious, because they start to get self-conscious. Like, if you're that crazy, they're like, do I look fat? You know, and it spreads through the whole family.
It does. It's alcoholism. It's the same thing.
Is it?
Yeah. I mean, in my opinion, anything that fills the hole, so to speak.
I'm having a carb problem now.
Oh.
I'm like, I cannot do it. Like,
you mean you can't have them, or you're just overdoing them?
Well, no, I just want them.
You just want them.
I'm jonesing because I'm feeding it. I'm not really overdoing it, but I do beat the shit out of myself in order not to.
Well, it's your head more. I mean, for me, it is. I find that over the years, and I've been able to moderate. I can kind of eat most things.
Yeah.
Like, well, even that bag of Swedish fish last night was probably not a great idea.
I'm so glad I don't have that.
You don't have the candy sugar thing?
I like chocolate and cake and pie.
Okay.
But I don't like gummy bears and Swedish fish.
But don't you know that's an eating, the excuse for gummy bears and all that is because there's no,
carby?
It's just straight sugar.
No carby.
Anyway, I think the point is that I think with years of recovery, what I've learned.
Do you do OA?
I have been. I did not really
kind of
qualify.
Feel shitty going there, don't you?
Totally embarrassed. Didn't want to go.
Person at OA, the worst.
Well, here was the worst. It used to be in the old days, you know, every rag magazine would infest the 12-step world. I didn't mind that the National Enquirer said I was like a drug addict. But when they said I was like, I was like totally mortified. I thought, no.
Oh, I didn't realize they did that. That was happening?
Oh, my God. They used to be.
What time were you in the 80s? When?
You know, when I got sober, when I was in 1986. And I got sober at the Log Cabin in West Hollywood.
Architects of Adversity?
Oh, my favorite. That was my favorite when they throw chairs around shit.
But so the press would break anonymity.
Oh, the press would be there. That's when I learned really quickly to share in a general way, because almost everything I'd ever said in a 12-step room.
That's so fucking heinous. Because is that still happening? I don't feel that it's happening.
I don't think so. I don't read I don't look.
I guess there was sort of a wave where, like, you know, AA was sort of like somehow, it seemed like there was a time where people would meet people at meetings. There was a hip factor to meetings for a while, right?
Well, when I
that's
got,
definitely not the case.
No, you used to, in the 80s, we'd get dressed up to go to meetings.
Yeah.
I mean, it was like, you know, because if you figure you're an addict since you're young, you're sort of socially inept. You have a lot of social anxiety, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that was part of my thing.
Uh-huh.
I couldn't deal with people.
Right.
So I get sober, and there would be these social meetings where, you know, my sponsor would say to me, yeah, go talk to people. I'd be like, I don't, I, you know.
Oh, you want to look good, man. Here. If you're going to Third and Gardner, you better look fucking
Third
good.
Third and Gardner.
Like, it's like this royalty sitting at the front, right. Like the whole fucking thing.
Or Rodeo. Did you ever, well, I don't know if you. If
Rodeo, I went to Rodeo like once or twice, but I was like, I got sober in New York. So I've been out here since 2002 and I was sort of a East Side guy, you know, Silver Lake. But I dressed up. You want to look good.
Yeah, you do. Well, you know, it's like social and there's cute girls and cute boys and keep
everyone's working it too.
Kind of. Well, you know, the ones, I remember when I first got sober and, you know, I was just all over, like, whatever dude was cute. I mean, I was, you know, anything to fix.
I'm going to have to put a trigger warning on this episode for bleeding deacons who hold on to the tradition. Like, you guys, you're breaking the tradition. Yeah, well.
Yeah, but I remember the guys that were actually, you know, cool dudes would just look at me and say, you know what? You're not sober long enough. Just sit down.
Oh, just, yeah.
Like, okay.
Yeah, yeah.
All right.
Very pretty. Sit down.
That's right. Don't talk.
But wait, let's go back. So you start on diet pills, and that's where it starts?
Yeah. When I was 14, my parents
took me. Who told you you were fat?
My dad,
the
director. My dad, the director, the house had to be perfect. I was supposed to be perfect. Even though, what's funny is, you know, he had a food thing. Mm. So, like, you know, he was just projecting onto me.
But what do you mean? He was self-conscious about it?
No, his weight would go up and down. He was like a food guy. He was like a...
But he knew it. He'd be uncomfortable fat?
Always on a diet.
Oh, not a comfortable...
Not on a diet.
Not a happy fat guy.
Yeah, not a happy fat guy.
Oh, okay.
And he wasn't really a fat guy. Like, when I look at pictures, nobody was as, you know.
Yeah.
So they take me to the doctor... Gives me diet pills. I did not. I don't think I lost any weight, but I felt a lot better. I think I needed, you know, antidepressants.
Sure.
Is probably what I needed.
Yeah.
And so then self-medicating just started then.
So, okay. So you found that you felt better. You were still chubby, but you were on your way with
but
the drug.
But I didn't give a shit.
Yeah.
I didn't care.
You're thinking, man. You're doing
and that's what I was thinking. And I taught myself to play the piano. I'm writing songs. I'm prolific. I'm just, this is the way for me.
Jacked.
Yeah. Smoking cigarettes.
Nice.
Drinking wine on the weekends, smoking weed. I didn't really think there was any problem
and
at all.
You were like, what, 17?
Oh, 14 I started. By the time, but then, you know, the prescriptions would run out. So then I'm buying Black Beauties and I'm doing a lot of different things.
Yellow jackets,
yes. Oh my God. Yes, I have not
all
heard that in a long time. Yeah. And then before I know it, it's the 80s, and then I'm on the road.
Blow.
Then I'm like, yeah, then I'm in
the
that
dumbest
world.
Drug of all.
The dumbest drug ever.
Speed was so much better.
Well.
In the sense that, like, you know.
It's cheaper.
Well, you could take a pill and
longer.
You can be by yourself, and you didn't have to follow somebody around.
I could do blow and be by myself.
Right, but I mean, you still had to deal with it and it'd go away quick.
Yeah.
I mean, you take some pills, it's like you're good for a few hours. You don't have to keep going to the fucking bathroom.
Yep, that's true. See, you know all this stuff. Yes, it's so true.
No, but I did coke too. It just, in like, fiending on coke and how embarrassing that gets, you know, and the places you end up because of that shit, it's crazy. But you're on the road with who? How does it start the music career? How do you become a background singer?
Well, I dropped out of college. That's why I started that. I went to CalArts for 6 months.
With David Hasselhoff.
Yeah, and Paul Rubens. And then
were you friends with them?
Oh yeah, I just talked to Paul. I talk to Paul all the time. Paul's so great.
I don't know why he hasn't been on this
person.
Show.
Right. He's a great guy. You should have him. He's
I don't
fantastic.
Know why it hasn't happened.
Anyway, so I'm in college and then I drop and I was in the theater department because my dad would only let me go if I could audition. This is where it all gets kind of like, well, I guess I had some natural talent because I got into these places.
Right.
But I didn't want to do it. So I got a job in a road company of a Broadway show. I was the chorus girl.
Uh-huh.
And I just sang in that.
Yeah.
And I
what show?
It was called Two Gentlemen of Verona.
Mm.
I went on the road for like 9 months.
Yeah.
And then I came home and then I got a job as a singing waitress. And I worked in this restaurant and then I got a record deal.
In the 80s?
In the 80s. And now it's, I think we're almost to the 80s.
Yeah.
Maybe 70, late 70s. Whenever Kiss came out, because Kiss, Gene Simmons is who took me to Casablanca Records and got me a record deal.
How do you meet that monster?
I was his waitress.
And that's how it happened?
Yes.
And you were his singing waitress?
I was his singing waitress. And
this was like at the beginning of Kiss?
It was their first concert in Los Angeles.
Holy shit.
And they were playing at the Santa Monica Civic.
And they're all from like Long Island, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And he was probably like still like a reasonable rock Jew at that point.
Oh, he was a fantastic rock Jew. And the only person I'd ever met that never had a drink or a drug. I mean, he was wild. He was like straight up business.
Uh-huh.
And I was taken with him. Yes.
But what I'm saying is you met him before he fully got degenerate.
Yeah.
I think his bag is sex, right?
Well, it was then. I don't know if his bag is still sex. I don't know now, but...
Like, it's got to come out somewhere.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. That was definitely his jam.
Yeah.
And it turned out that I was in a band at the time with a guy he went to college with. It was just this weird sort of thing that happened.
Synchronicity.
And before I knew it, we had a record deal, and I started making records, and then that...
Solo records.
Well, this was with a band... my first record.
What's the band called?
It was called The Group With No Name.
Not a good name.
Horrible name.
Terrible.
It was Neil Bogart's idea at Casablanca Records. I don't know if you know who that was.
I do know that name.
He was the prez.
The big guy.
He was a big guy, yeah.
Yeah.
So that happened, and then that didn't happen, and then I was like a singer for hire, and I would go back and forth between the restaurants.
But you're dating Gene?
I did long distance. Yes, I did. Yes. I guess you call it dating.
Right.
You know.
You'd hook up here and there.
Yeah, for me, I was like madly in love, but yeah. he was not.
But he must have been on the road constantly.
Constantly.
Yeah. And you sang on a record of his?
I did.
The when they all did their little solo
records? Their solo
project?
Records.
Yeah.
Yeah, I sang on his solo record.
Oh,
yeah.
How bad was that?
Yeah.
I can't remember those records. I was not a Kiss kid.
Me neither. I didn't.
And it was my age group too, but I didn't go in. I didn't go in because I was in high school then and I didn't.
I listened to a lot of rhythm and blues. I had a guy who turned me on to Robert Johnson when I was in high
school.
Sure,
yeah, I got that.
So I listened to all that. I remember running off to the Ash Grove, which is now the Improv.
No, I hear about this place.
You know,
yeah.
Which used to burn down yearly.
Right.
It used to burn down all the time. But I'd go run off and hear Taj Mahal and Willie Dixon.
Yeah,
and,
they were always hanging out. Some guys had residencies there.
Yeah.
So that's where you started singing with those guys or touring with them?
No, I toured with Etta James. I sang with Etta.
This is after the No Name Band didn't.
This is after the No Name
Band.
Got
no hits.
Got no hits. Got no nothing. Then we moved to Elektra Records. Got even less.
Who was in that band with you? They still around?
Yes, I think so. I don't think you would know any of them.
Oh,
you wouldn't know any of them.
They didn't go on to other bands?
No, I mean, the only one that
a lot of records.
Ended up being in that band was my friend Brian Ray, who plays with Paul McCartney.
Oh, okay.
And he was in our side band because the band was five singers. It was kind of like the Mamas and the Papas.
Oh, okay, that's nice.
And then, you know, we ended up having a band. I ended up marrying the bass player. I mean, it goes on and on.
That was the first husband?
That was the first husband who taught me about Otis Redding and Al Green. I think that's why I married him.
Oh, those are both good stories.
Yep.
Both ended sadly. Well,
both
ended, not so terrible, but there was a bad story in the Al Green story.
Yeah. How did Otis, plane crash.
Right, but Al, didn't he get in trouble for a woman threw a pot of boiling water on him? Or was it the other way? I can't remember.
Oh, yeah, no, you're right.
And then he became a reverend.
Yeah.
He got God because he was out of his mind.
Yeah, and the music suffered.
Yeah. Sometimes God doesn't help music. Sometimes you got to turn your back on God and take the tricks elsewhere.
That's right.
It's always a price to pay. So the bass player taught you about that.
He did. He was he played in a band called the Soul Survivors. Do you remember that?
Yeah,
Expressway to Your Heart.
Oh, is that it?
So I married him. And so those people, they were in that band,
yeah.
But nobody else you would know. And after that, I was like a singer for hire. I had bands. I was trying to get record deals.
So with the record company, you had an agent and a record company that kind of would say like, oh, we got a girl that does this. And
oh, no, no agent. There was no agent at that point. And then I lost my record deal. And so I remember when I worked with Bette Midler for 5 years. And that
How
was
that?
That was pretty amazing. That was pretty great. I went all around the world with her.
People love her.
Love her. And that was an open cattle call audition. That was like hundreds of girls lined up, you know, to go into this soundstage and sing and dance.
Why no acting?
I didn't want to.
Oh, it's just this is what
it was
you
just really
to.
I was going to be a musician. That was it. I just didn't even.
How many solo records you put out?
I've put out my first one was when I was on Married with Children. I still did not give up, and so I got a deal on Virgin Records, and I put out a solo record. I've put out four.
Mm.
I think four solo records. I make them, you know, now I just make them. And at that point I was very invested in like, okay, people are going to take me seriously. I wrote every song on this record. I know I'm an actor, but I'm a musician. Uh-uh.
I want them to know this part of me
too.
And
then I'd go on those radio tours and I'd be like, could you say Al? And I was like, no, this is not happening.
Morning radio?
No, they don't care. So now I just make records because I like to make records.
That's great.
And I have a band and I play in my band.
That's nice.
I know, it's super great. It's kind of like, well, I'm sure, I mean, you make your living as an actor and as a stand-up, yes?
Yeah, and as this.
And this.
Yeah.
Yeah, and this. But what's your first love? Comedy? Who knows? You don't love any? No, you do.
I do comedy because I have to, in my mind, in my heart. Like, it's like a, oh, it's a calling.
It's a soul thing, yeah.
I don't always love it. And oddly, since we've had this year of terror off and grief for me, I haven't missed it that much in a way, you know? Like, it's a compulsive thing. It's how I own my space in the world. It runs pretty deep. But love is a weird, like, I can't romanticize it. It's like eating in a way. I do like to play guitar. I like the music, but I'm not that confident. I've gotten pretty good at it.
Good.
But I should, it's one of those things where it's like I should play with other people a bit.
Yes. It's
but,
great.
Yeah, and acting sort of relatively new for me to get to understand how to make it satisfying.
Right. Yeah, it takes a minute. I mean, when I first came to acting, actors hate when I say this, but it just sort of happened. I didn't go to acting school and I didn't train for it.
Yeah.
It was more a last minute, like I was so broke that I was like, I got to just open any door that comes along. And I ended up doing this little musical that these friends of mine wrote in a garage.
Right.
And agents came to see it. And they came to see it because Pam Adlon was in it. Pammy was in it with me. This is when Pammy was like 16.
Pam. Yeah.
And they came down.
What was that called?
It was called Backstreet.
Uh-huh.
And we went and we were in this old play. And these agents approached me and they said, do you want to have an agent? And I was like, no, I don't really want to do that. I don't want to be an actor. And they kept coming. They came like two or three times. And then finally I realized, they said, yeah, but you could work as an actor. And I was like, well, okay. So yeah. I just said yes. And
well, how come you're broke?
Because I was broke because,
what
you know.
What year is that?
This was 19, I wasn't sober yet, so it was 1984.
But I mean, like, you're touring with Bette Midler all over the world, and then you tour with other people. There's not a lot of money in that, or are you just doing too many drugs or fucking up?
All that. You know,
you have kids yet?
No, no kids.
And
no,
you,
no, no,
who
no,
else
no,
you
no.
tour with?
I toured with Etta, I toured with Bette, I toured with Tanya Tucker.
Oh, she's great.
Oh, she was great. When she was with Glenn Campbell, I had great stories, and he was on the bus with us, and yeah, I did
that.
What
a great guitar player.
Oh, an amazing guy and great guitar player. Yeah, he was. And his kind of, I could say some stuff. I'll tell you later.
Uh-huh.
Anyway, I did a lot of session stuff. I sang on Olivia Newton-John's records. I was kind of like, I never learned how to read music, but I have a very good ear. So I'd be, you know,
yeah.
I could kind of eke by. I also had a manager that was throwing me money if I couldn't pay my rent.
How bad are you in the drugs?
How bad was I at that point?
Yeah.
Pretty bad. I was
mostly
pretty...
blow or what?
It was blow. It was pills. It was alcohol. I was kind of like a little chemist. I was what they call high bottom in terms of I was still functioning in the world.
Sure.
And like when
you were also in a world that was saturated with drugs and booze.
Saturated.
That was just the life, right?
That was the life.
Mm.
And, you know, it wasn't until I started working in television and I realized, oh, shit, you know, I can't stay up till 4 a.m.
This is a real job.
I got to be there. And my first job on television, I'll never forget, the woman who was in it was a sober person. And she would talk about
it. What job was that?
I'm just going to say. It was with Mary Tyler Moore.
Oh, okay.
And Mary was well known as a sober person.
Yeah.
And I remember I went to that job and she would talk about it and I'd lie to her. I'd say, yeah I'm sober too.
Oh,
and I'm thinking, I'm such a fucking liar. Years later, she was my Eskimo. Years later, I took her out in New York and I told her the truth. And I said, I have to thank you because you are the reason I ended up in a room. I mean, she's one of the reasons.
What show was that?
It was called The Mary Show. It was Mary Tyler Moore's return after... the big Mary Tyler Moore show.
Sure.
She played a divorcee. Danny DeVito directed it. He gave me the gig. This is me, like little rock singer. I'm like, what's happening? And they bring me in. So,
and this is after you do the play with Pam?
No, this is after, as soon as I signed with an agent, I got a gig at the Mark Taper in a big musical, like opera, a rock opera. I played a Russian Jew in a rock opera.
Great.
That I didn't speak one word, and I sobbed and cried, and CBS said, "You want to be on a comedy?" And I was like, "Yeah, I'll come audition."
Yeah.
So I got the job, and then there was Mary, and it was a whole new thing to me.
What was she like?
She was very, this, now I understand why she was what she was. She was guarded. She was very, like, not super engaging. Not, and I think it's because
like
she was Mary
people?
Tyler Moore. No, not cold, just self-protective.
Okay.
You know, you're Mary Tyler Moore.
She's a huge star, yeah.
You know, so she was, but she was great. I mean, she was awesome with me. Like, I didn't even know how to put my face in the light. She would come over and lift my chin up and say, "Here, you know, you do this,
yeah,
do that."
I still don't know which camera I'm on.
Me neither. Or when they say camera left, camera right, I'm like, wait a minute, what do you mean? Just raise a hand.
I just, like, I started to learn how to say, like, where's my camera? So we're, okay, got it. Which one are we? Okay.
Yeah. I mean, in hindsight, I realized because that job ended. I'm still not sober. And I just thought, well, I'll just go back to my rock and roll, my job, my day job, my real job.
And you started doing the background stuff again?
No, I got married with children, like almost within 3 months. Oh, I got so that's what happened. I left that job.
With Mary.
And then shit got bad. What does that mean?
Well, I mean, if we're talking.
What does that look like? I had a boyfriend at the time.
Oh, see, it's already.
It's already a boyfriend,
It's already terrible.
I know. His name was Spider.
Oh,
there you go.
It's getting better.
It's getting better.
Yeah.
And Spider and I were, you know, he was in a band with this guy named Chucky Weiss. I don't know if you know Chucky.
Yeah, Chucky. Chucky's
the
in love.
Liars. Yeah, Chucky's in love.
The Cantor scene.
Yeah. I was at the Cantor scene.
With Ricky Lee Jones and Waits and Chucky Weiss. And
yeah, all that. And Spider.
So you knew young Tom.
I met young Tom.
Oh, okay.
I didn't actually know him. Mm. I knew Chuck. I knew Chuck really well. And I know Ricky.
Yeah.
So
Spider.
Yeah.
Did she write a song about Spider?
No.
Too? I feel like I've heard of Spider.
No, I don't think she wrote a song about Spider.
Spider wasn't in love.
I was in love with Spider.
Of course,
and
you were.
Of course, I was. And it just got like how it gets, which is like a daily thing and not good. And,
you know, and
I always kind of knew. I knew from early on that something was up. That this is not good.
That you couldn't control it.
That I couldn't control it.
Right.
That's what I knew.
And so, who got you? How'd you end up at? Over at the log cabin.
At the log cabin. Actually, Yucca was my first meeting. Spider ran off.
I know
off.
That church on Yucca.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't even know if they have meetings there anymore.
Yeah, maybe.
Whatever.
I don't know.
But Spider, Spider ran off with somebody. And I went to the meeting looking for Chuck, who was already in the club, hoping to find Spider. And I kind of walked in, and there were a bunch of people I knew. And they were like, "Oh, you're finally here. We've been saving your seat." And I just thought, what are they talking about? What do they
Spider?
Mean?
Where's
Spider? Sit down. Shut up. You know, those were the early sobriety days.
Yeah.
Sit down. Shut up. Wash this coffee cup.
Yeah.
Don't say anything.
Right.
And I just heard stuff, and then I just kept going. I think I was still looking for him.
We had so many friends there, though.
I did. I had a lot of friends.
I'm sure they wouldn't let you leave after that.
Well, and plus, you know, I mean, I knew, I knew it was, you know,
time.
It's dark. It's, you know,
chasing
how many
it.
Nights
yeah,
can you go through
worst.
That?
We're just jangled all the time.
You know, and your prayer is, God, please get me through this one.
Yeah.
You know?
Oh, yeah. The worst.
The worst.
Laying in bed.
Yeah.
And you can't even sleep.
You can't sleep. You can't do anything.
The worst. Well, good.
So there I am. I'm sober.
And then you got the gig.
And then I started working more as an actor. Yeah. Then my whole sort of... In fact, I was 2 months sober when I started working on Married with Children.
How'd you get that job?
I went to an audition. I mean, by this time I have an agent, right? So she sends me out. She sends me the script. She goes, "This is a network that isn't even a network yet."
So we got a good shot at this.
No, and I thought, oh, well, right up my alley. Because I'm not really, I'm not your mainstream actor.
Right,
they're going
right.
to like me.
Yeah.
And because I've never really fit. I still kind of don't. I feel like I don't really fit into the actor community so much.
Yeah.
And
you're better off.
And then I really didn't. Yeah. Then I was just like, yeah. You know. So right. I went in and auditioned and wore funny clothes, and Ed O'Neill was there, and we got, there were like, you know how they pair you up?
Yeah.
And Eddie and I just, you know, I don't know if you know Ed, but he's just a super regular dude.
Yeah.
He's just not actory.
Right.
And we got on great. So
now, how much of the character is your creation? Like, how is it written versus?
I think it was written more to be slovenly. Uh-huh. You know, it was supposed to be like Roseanne and Sam Kinison.
Oh, right.
Who I adored. And I thought, no, when I read it, yeah. I really thought, no, they have to have something going on. Because uh-huh. these two people have not been married either. So they have to have either a great sex life or uh-huh. something's going on. So I sexed her up. I went in all, you know, like dolled up and, uh-huh. you know,
yeah.
kind of like a 50s housewife
right,
in a way.
Right. Yeah,
or
yeah.
a little tight dress.
This is like a defining part of the show.
Well, they liked it. They liked the hit on it.
Yeah.
So, yeah. I mean, that was always my thing. Like, if these people are going to fight and, you know, she, you know, something has to be.
Can you imagine? Can you believe what a lightning rod that show was at that time?
Unbelievable.
And how it defined that network, you know, for to this day. And that if it weren't for your show, like The Simpsons probably wouldn't have happened. But it was a cultural lightning rod. Can you imagine such an innocent time where Married with Children was the lightning rod, the cultural lightning rod?
We were all stunned. I mean, I think, you know, for the first 3 years, you couldn't even get it unless you had like rabbit ears on your TV.
You couldn't get Fox.
Yeah, you couldn't get Fox. And so we didn't even know it was successful. We knew nothing. And then
right.
we kind of, Ed and I, I'll never forget, we went on some tour of bowling alleys or, I don't know, they sent us out on some like something.
Yeah.
And everybody was relating, you know, and we'd get fan mail saying, oh, my family is just like that, or I live next door to those people, or blah, blah.
Right, yeah,
and I thought, oh, wow, this is really, people are, this is like regular people.
It was a great caricature of a certain type of America.
Yeah, it really, really was.
And people
liked her clothes. People wanted Peg's clothes. I mean, it was wild.
It could land on either side. The people that got the joke and then the people that were the joke.
Oh, totally. And then the people that hated the joke and then, you know, boosted our ratings because they kept trying to get us off the air.
Right, right. It was mostly lefties, right?
No, it was this one woman I'll never forget. We sent her flowers every year. Her name was Terry Ricolta. And Terry Ricolta wrote this whole thing about, you know, her kid can't, you know, this is not okay for children. So,
So it was like,
tried to get us off the air.
Karen's.
Yeah.
The old version
exactly.
of the Karen. Yeah.
And all it did was got us on the front of the New York Times. And, you know, it doubled our audience as she
people
was trying. Yeah, they loved it.
It aggravated people.
Yeah, it really did. So.
Well, it was a great run. It was a long run. You know, got you, she must have made you pretty rich.
Yeah, I got pretty rich.
Yeah.
And then I got pretty poor, too, because I got divorced. And
well, wait, so when did you start having kids?
I started having kids when I was on Married with Children. My first child I lost. It was really another sad, you know, I got sad stories. I had a stillborn child, and they had written it into the series.
Uh-huh.
And then I lost that baby.
Oh.
And so that was horrible. So
oh,
they made
God.
It blah, blah. And then after that, I went on to have my two older kids and I was pregnant on the show. And then they would send me home and pay me. They were so like, just go home, lay down.
They weren't going to take the risk again.
So it was a great.
Oh, but that must have been so brutal to have that expectation, then have to go to set and like.
Ugh, it was horrible. It was really, really heartbreaking. But I also look at it like I wouldn't have the, you know, these amazing two older kids that I have if that hadn't happened. I wouldn't have anything, you know.
Oh, so in the divorce, you were the one with the money? Is that what happened?
Yes.
The fucking worst.
It was hard.
And this was the first husband? The bass
Second
player?
Second husband. This is the drummer.
Oh, okay. The drummer.
Who? I only have kind things to say about now because.
Two kids with him.
Okay. And I wouldn't have them without him. So.
And you guys get along? The kids get along with both of you?
Yeah. Everybody's good. Okay. Everybody's.
It happens, right?
You know.
Eventually?
Eventually. It's taken some time, but eventually, yeah.
Uh-huh. And you landed on your feet?
Landed on my feet. Somebody said to me, oh, don't worry about money, you know.
Yeah.
You'll make more money.
Someone said that to me, too. When I went through that divorce from that woman.
Ah.
See, right when you start talking about it.
Yeah.
it comes like it's sort of, and I'm way over it. But the point being,
yes,
people said, don't worry about the money. I'm like, you don't, I got nothing going. And I landed on my feet.
Yeah, you land on your feet. I don't know. You know, that's kind of how I sort of live my life like that now, too. I just sort of feel like, well, this looks like the shittiest thing that could ever happen. However, I've been there before, and then it wasn't the shittiest thing that's ever happened. So maybe I'm going to look at it that way.
Well, what I've start to realize is that none of it's unusual. It's something humans go through, no matter what it is.
Right.
There's nothing that's going to happen to you that's going to be like, that's never happened to a human before.
Oh, absolutely.
And there's something comforting about that.
It really
is. And that goes from going broke to getting sick to death, whatever.
All of it. It also goes to, you know, the thing that you think is impossible to accomplish. And if you can find that one person that's done it,
right,
then that means you can do it too.
Sure. So, but also there is something to be said about acknowledging your limitations. Like, I'm not going to be an astronaut.
Oh, that's, yeah. It's not. I know. I think that comes with age.
I think so.
I think, you know, like,
and it's helpful. But I wish you could do it. I recommend it, people do it
young.
You
know,
if you have talent, understand what and how to use it so it doesn't strangle you from the inside, you know?
Yeah, but how do you avoid, if you're creative, not being strangled from the inside? It's kind of all, I think it all kind of goes hand in hand.
There's some things I can't understand.
Me
I can't.
Me too.
The self-loathing thing and how that becomes an engine, I don't quite understand that. And I don't like when people think that you do it on purpose. Because it's like, why would anyone do that?
Right.
Why would anyone nurture that? Like this idea, it's like, you're just like that so you can create. I'm like, believe me.
No. I do not.
I don't want to be like this.
No. I mean, it's all, the whole, you know, it's like trying to turn your head off. You know, it's like, I don't want to think this much.
I've gotten better, man. Do you meditate?
I am an inconsistent meditator.
I've been so on it lately.
Have you been meditating a lot?
But I didn't do it for years.
Right.
I just started like 4 or 5 months ago.
Oh, that's odd. What kind of, do
just
you
breath.
Have a breath?
I do Andy Biddle Dummy. I always fuck his name up. Headspace app.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Andy Biddlecomb.
You're the third person recently. I should listen to. I went
it's
to a teacher.
It's just a guided breath meditation. It's not, there's no visuals. It's counting breaths, staying in the breath. When thoughts come, get back to the breath. That's it.
Do you do it more than once a day?
Or? Once a day, 15 minutes.
Okay, that's great. See, I went to a teacher who said to me, you have to do this twice a day for 20 minutes. And I was like,
that's the TM thing.
TM. And I could, and I've done that consistently for periods of time, and then I can't, and then I screw up my own expectation. You know, my expectation is like, well, if I can't do it twice a day, I'm just not going to do it at all. And so that's messed up.
That's the only thing I'm learning from it all during this thing, this lockdown and whatever we've all been through is like, if I don't have this routine.
Right.
And like, I don't, like now I get up, like I started doing like 5 sun salutations, about 10 minutes of yoga. And then I do the meditation every day. But I also work out with a trainer 3 times a week and hike 2 times a week. So I'm like on it.
Wow.
But I do it. Even when I wake up, it's like that thing about when you first get sober, you make your bed, that shit.
Yep.
Like I still do it.
Right.
Like I get up to today, I'm like, maybe I'll just put the meditation off. And then I'm doing it.
Right.
I'm doing the meditation. Like that voice is secondary now.
Oh, I love that.
Right.
And do you feel better or do you feel centered?
I feel like I did it.
Right, which is good.
Right. It's a lot of it. I don't know what the meditation is doing for me.
I think it's a cumulative effect. I mean, to me, what I understand and what I've experienced is that you spend that time observing your thoughts, right? That's what meditation is.
Well, you do see the difference between you and your brain.
Exactly.
That's happening.
Right.
Where the difference between mind and brain.
Right.
Yeah.
So then you don't attach so much to all those crazy thoughts.
Well, it's like that whole thing about feelings aren't thoughts or whatever. Aren't facts. But like, I still have problems with that. They kind of are facts.
Hmm.
They may not, you may not, the thoughts that go with feelings may not be the greatest and you might not want to act on them. But, you know, feelings are feelings. But like, I think it's like that sober thing too, where it's just sort of, the next right thing, like there's that trick of getting into the present where you really start to realize, and I've known this for a long time, but I don't think I've known it as deeply since I've meditated, that most of what you're reacting to, your brain is making up for one reason or another.
Completely.
You know, and you don't have much control over that, but you can with meditation separate it.
Right.
more successfully, I think.
I have a friend who's a big meditator who always tells me that the brain is the brain's purpose is to tell you to turn right and then to turn left and then to get, you know, go when the light is green.
Right.
And we assign all these other things to the brain. The brain is not to figure out all the stuff that we try to figure out.
Well, yeah. And I used to say that all the time. I just got to figure this out. I just got to figure, you know. And it's so fucking dumb.
Yeah, alcoholic. Think your way through it. Well, it's dumb. Well, and then, you know, that's the whole deal.
What are you going to figure out, though?
Yeah, figuring out is not a step. Is not a...
Yeah, and then there's just the paranoia, the resentment journey.
Oh, no.
Yeah. Where it's just like, it comes out of nowhere. Like, I'm grateful as fuck, and everything's fine. Everything is fine. I cannot sit with that. Like, even during this fucking lockdown, every day my nature is to get up and go like, oh, fuck, I gotta, what? Right. What do you have to, nothing.
Yeah.
There's nothing.
Well, it's an alcoholic response. You know, if you really believe that alcoholism lives in your brain, which is really what it is, the substances aren't really what it's about.
Yeah.
The alcoholic thinking is what fucks with us, and it tells you, uh-oh, before it says, oh, boy. It's like, you know, you wake up just like, oh.
Here we go.
And then, you know, you know, through the process of recovery, I don't think it ever stops. That's what I've learned. I don't think that initial sort of, uh-oh.
This is my 22nd stops. Year.
Yeah, so you just learn how to manage it. That's my experience. You just learn how to not.
Yeah, and but you know what happens, though, is like you do deeply realize and understand that some shit just is not that important.
Oh.
And, you know, that's the relief of age and sobriety, is that like, yeah, it's like, what the fuck was I worked up about? Like, right. If you think back on all the insanity, it's this is so stupid.
I know. I mean, I used to really, yeah. Relationships and work, those are my big insane, I mean, you know, trying to figure out what if, and this is going to happen. I mean, nothing is, you know, it's like, you know how it's funny when people say to you, how do you make those career decisions? How did you plan to do blah, blah, blah? And you're just like, what do you mean? I didn't plan anything.
I don't know what's going to happen tomorrow.
That's right. And, you know, somebody offers you this and you take, you know, it's really.
Flying by the seat of your pants.
Exactly.
Trying to hide your desperation.
Exactly. That's what I feel too.
But like six years ago, I asked a mentally ill person to marry me.
Oh, wow.
Like I never realized the depth of my codependency until I got into a relationship where I could not see it.
Yeah.
And like everyone around me is like, dude, no one said anything, of course.
Right.
But I broke up with this woman and I had to take out a restraining order and I got back together with them.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
That shit is done. That's not going to happen to me again.
See, that stuff, I think when it gets that extreme, I really do think you one and done. I think you learn it. I think you really know. Then you see the signs.
Especially if you dodged a fucking bullet.
You dodged a bullet, yeah. I remember my second marriage and I didn't know how to get out. I didn't know how to, and there was all kind of shit going on. And I was like, I got to get out of here. And I couldn't get out. I was like, and, you know, my next husband, who's my current husband, I would like, you know, I just was more aware.
Yeah.
I just had a better picker. I remember my first coffee date with my current husband, I took my sponsor with me.
Really?
Yeah, because I thought, I don't know what's good. Yeah. I was like,
I brought my security team.
I did. Like, and halfway through, she goes, yeah, I think you're good. It's okay. So she left.
That's cute.
It was necessary. I was not, you know, I don't like to repeat my, I don't know. That's one of the benefits of sobriety. I
don't know where the fuck I got the energy. Man. I don't know. Like, I look like I just got a kitten, you know, and I've been through this shit with these cats before, you know, where it's just, you forget the insanity. But like, when I look back at certain relationships, like even the horrible ones where I was a monster and whatever, like, I don't know where it comes from, but it's probably still in there somewhere.
The monster?
Sure.
Oh, 100%. Are you kidding? I don't think we lose our defects. I mean, that's why, you know, the benefit of sobriety is the benefit and the struggle is now you're awake.
You are awake. You can make choices.
You have no choice but to do. I mean, I suppose you can just live in bad behavior. You can just sort of do that. However, you're just, you know, you're awake and aware and you have to take responsibility and you're accountable.
It's
you're
terrible.
All that shit.
Well,
man,
that
I'll tell you what. I know, right? So then you go shopping too much and hopefully you don't
I just try to balance sugar and caffeine. And, like, I can't even let myself do the shopping to the degree I should have a good time.
I know.
So we all right? We good? We get it all covered?
I think so. I don't know. We didn't talk much about work. Oh, we did talk about my TV show.
Yeah. It was like yesterday.
Watch my new TV show.
Yeah. The Rebel. It's just Rebel.
Rebel.
She's saving the world.
She's trying to, yeah. She's actually a very...
Very entertaining.
She's an empowering... Thanks for saying that. She's an empowering... what I like playing about her the most is she empowers other people. She's not...
It's all about that.
She's not about, here, let me catch the fish for you. It's about, here, take the pole...
Yeah.
Go down to the stream.
Yeah.
And figure it out.
Yeah. No, it's enjoyable.
Great.
Did you do any juice stuff?
Any juice stuff? No, I don't. My dad was like, more a socialist than anything else. He was not a religious Jew. Mm. One time we had a Passover. This is funny. We had a Passover service at my house and my dad put on this record by this guy named Moshe Oisha.
Yeah.
And he was trying to follow the record.
Right.
And so my little Yiddish grandmother comes over and was so condescending and mean to him and just like laughed at him.
Yeah.
So that was it. There went the record. There went Passover. That was it.
But you never went over to the Lears or anything like that?
Oh, no, I did. I had Passover with the Lears about 5 years ago. All of us came over and he had all the kids over in my family.
The many Lear kids.
The many, and then their
generations,
Lear kids.
Yes.
Yes. He's got awesome kids.
Well, he's got a kid that's in his 20s or 30s.
Twins, yeah. They're girls. They're twins.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that he had with Lynn.
Uh-huh.
They're wonderful. They're great. He's, you know, I love Norman. I did his podcast just a little while ago.
I didn't know he had one.
He did.
The last time I saw him was at, I think it was at Bob Saget's birthday party.
Oh.
Is that possible? Yeah, it's a Bob Saget's birthday party at somebody's house that's built on the Sharon Tate house was. Big producer of probably that show Bob was on.
Oh, yeah. I was at a party at that house, too, and Tom Jones performed. Is that the same house?
Probably. Big old house.
Oh, my God. I went with Craig Schumacher. Do you know Craig Schumacher?
Yeah, sure.
So Craig invited me.
The
Love Master. So he invited me to this party and we went and he goes, come to this thing and Tom Jones is going to, you know, and I was like, hey man, it's 1 a.m. Where's Tom Jones? Yeah. I'm tired now.
Yeah. And he came.
And he finally showed up.
Yeah. Me and Norman and I think Bill Burr had a cigar. The old man smoked a cigar.
Wow. Love it. Was 90s. It by the grotto? Do you remember that water grotto?
It was like, somewhere in there. Yeah. But this is the house that guy built, right? The producer, what was the show that Saget was on?
You know, the drummer with John Stamos.
Yes.
My kid watches it now. Not growing. I can't think of the name now. But yes,
so stupid.
That show
made $1 billion. That guy
$1 billion and built that house.
Well, it was a pleasure.
It was really nice to see you, meet you. I feel like I had met you before, but I don't know if I have.
Well, we've known each other for centuries.
Have we?
Sure. It's good to go back in many lives, all the way back to the Ukraine.
Ah, maybe. Yeah. I know. It does seem the older you get, feels like you know everybody.
Well, there's some people you know, you just kind of, you get a sense of.
You vibe with.
You're going to have some hand sanitizer?
I am.
Knock yourself out.
I will. Thank you.
Well, good luck with the show.
Thank you so much, Mark. I'm thrilled to have been here.
It's nice to see you.
Bye.
How was that? That was great, right? How good was that? I have to get her. I gave her a mug and it broke and she hasn't gotten back to me. I want to get her a mug, a Brian Jones mug that isn't broken. It's so nice to have people back in the room here. Also, did I mention Katie's new show, Rebel, airs Thursdays on ABC. It premieres tonight at 10 p.m. Eastern. I did two takes on this music because the first one I didn't want. And I just landed on another stinky blues riff. That moved me in the moment.
Thank you.
Riffs and Monkey and La Fonda, Cat Angels fucking everywhere. But Sammy the Red is here and Buster's on top of it. Too many cats!